The Secrets of Technology is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
Hi, I'm Dom Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Technology, where we discuss the technology news that's important to you from a uniquely Catholic point of view. And joining me today on the panel are Thomas Senerho. Hey, Thomas.
Hey, Dom.
And Jack Barazzini. Hey, Jack.
Hey, Dom.
Folks, I want to tell you about another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy called The Secrets of Doctor Who, which is very timely, pun intended, because the new season of Doctor Who is just about to drop on, BBC if you're in the UK, but also on Disney Plus for everywhere else in the world, featuring the newest Doctor. And Jimmy, Father Corey, and I are going to be talking all about it as it airs in June. So get on board with The Secrets of Doctor Who right now, and you can join us as we explore Doctor Who in the new season. And we've also got some great stuff coming up before and after as well. And you can find that wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/Doctor Who. So before we get into our main topics today, Jack, we got a little feedback from a listener. They had a question, and you gave them a great answer. So let me read this question, and then we can talk about the answer you gave. Ted Coville emailed in. He said, "I purchased a Steam Deck late last fall, and I'm really enjoying it. My decision to purchase the device was influenced by the recommendations by the team and the positive reviews. I started playing Elder Scrolls V, and that's where I started to see problems. For the most part, the game works well, and I've not had problems, but sometimes the game locks up. I reboot, and it locks up again. This can happen several times during a session. I changed the setting from online mode to offline mode. That seemed to help a little bit, I think, but it still locks up. Sometimes it doesn't lock up at all. I next purchased Star Wars Jedi Survivor. This is not a Steam Deck certified game, and there were warnings when I started playing. Same issue with the locking up, but much more often." So, Jack, you get a lot of experience with Steam Deck and, manipulating it and modifying the, you know, in the software side. What would you say for someone who's, you know, got a Steam Deck or looking to get a Steam Deck and they want to get the most out of the Steam Deck?
Well, I think the first thing you should do is go through this list of plugins that we have here. They'll increase the usability of the Steam Deck. There's a lot of little optimizations you can do, and there's also plugins that give you rankings for games, like based on how well they're going to run. So there's this thing called Deki, which is the Deki loader, and it's kind of a front end and a framework for loading in all these plugins. And you can get that at deki.xyz, and we'll have those links in the show notes for everyone. And ProtonDB is one of the first plugins I would install. It gives you a ranking on the Steam store and on all your Steam games, kind of like how, like, if you look at the Steam store, it'll say if it's certified or not, but that's really all they give you. This one rates it by, like, platinum, gold, silver, and bronze, I think, or unsupported. And it also gives you a bunch of FAQs and user reviews with information on what you can do to optimize your game, like different settings you can turn on or turn off and stuff like that. So that's been really helpful when trying to get stuff to run. Another one is called Cryo Utilities, and this goes through and does a bunch of little optimizations on the Steam Deck that can get your games running better. There's also one called Storage Cleaner, and it basically will allow you to clear out all the like extra temporary files that your games will download. And that just helps to free up space. Or if you've got something stuck in memory, you can clear that out and then just restart, and that'll help a lot. It's also important to remember there's kind of like a sliding scale of compatibility with games. Like, so you got to kind of figure out what annoyances you can put up with and what ones are going to be like game breaking. A couple other things you can do is for games that have that small text issue. I know that's one of the ones that Skyrim has, where it was built for a keyboard and mouse. So you have like text boxes you have to enter in. It's not very often. And then sometimes the text will be unreadable on this Steam Deck screen. Those things are more of annoyances, but I know Jedi Survivor is one of those games where I think it's just it's new enough that it's kind of above the limits of what the deck can run. So there's going to be some games that you simply can't get running, but I would definitely recommend checking out Proton DB because it has a lot of settings and a lot of optimizations you can do from other users.
Okay. Yeah, the one I've done is that Cryo Utilities, and that helped a lot. I was having a lot of issues, especially with the EA games, the Star Wars games and that sort of thing, which much of it went away once I did that. I do still occasionally run into problems. Like I ran into a problem where my kids love playing Battlefront, and every time they would launch Battlefront, it would never load. And I finally ended up having to, I wiped it out from the drive, and I did a bunch of stuff. I'm not sure which one of those things worked, but eventually it got to work. It's the Steam Deck is still a Linux machine running Windows emulators. And so it's never going to be perfect, I think, unless it's a very simple older game.
Mm-hmm.
But these will take you a long way to getting things running.
I would also say for EA games, because one of the biggest problems with their games is they have their like EA game thing wrapped around the game where you have to log in with an account and you have to be online. And that's really what causes a lot of those issues. So whenever I set up an EA game on my Steam Deck, I actually do it by plugging it into a monitor and using a keyboard and mouse because it's much easier to go through that initial setup and get it working. And then you're usually able to play no problem. So I'd recommend that if you're having trouble with those annoying login screens.
I have a Bluetooth keyboard that I pair to it. So I have a full size keyboard and a full size mouse. I do a Bluetooth mouse as well. And that way it's so much easier. And you could actually even, I have mine. I got an HDMI cable. I hook it to my TV when I want to. I mean, sometimes I just hook it to it. So to play off of the big screen, but sometimes or you could do Steam Link, which is a nice option. There's actually an Apple TV app called Steam Link that lets you stream the image from the Steam Deck to the TV. So it's a little bit laggy, but not actually all that bad. So it's playable that way. So that way you get a nice big view.
Yeah. Oh, one more thing I just thought of. If there are certain games that you want to play that either aren't available on Steam or just don't run on the Steam Deck hardware, you could look into the Xbox Game Pass because there are ways to play that on the Steam Deck. And that's basically one of those streaming services where you can play a lot of different games, but they're just going to be streamed to your device. And I haven't done that on the Steam Deck, but I've done it on my computer, which is not a gaming computer. And that's worked really well. And I know that people have gotten that working on Steam Deck.
Oh, I'll have to look at that because that new Star Wars Outlaws game is going to be console only. So I really want to Star Wars games. It's I'm always into that. That's cool. That's a great idea. Awesome. So Ted, hopefully that helps you and other folks. And if you have other questions, we love to, to try to help you best we can on the show. So if you get any questions, email them into us at technology@sqpn.com. So our main topic today is something that just kind of showed up. I forget where the link came from, but someone shared this link to this Atlantic article, which is the headline is "Maybe You Missed It, But the Internet Died 5 years Ago."
I love it.
It's basically an article about this conspiracy theory that exists on the internet that it's called the dead internet theory, which says that the internet died as a independent entity, as a freewheeling place for with people years ago, and that it is now mostly bots and deep fake generated content propagated by the government or some other, nefarious people, aliens or whatnot, to manipulate us and to, to keep us, whatever you think they're trying to do, make us do, that's what they're doing. And it really, it's not even just like most of the internet is, there's a lot of bot traffic or there's a lot of spam bots. No, the idea is that nearly everything online, the people on Twitter, the websites you go to, everything is fake, that the internet is really dead. And it's fascinating because, well, conspiracy theories are often fun, but it's also fascinating to kind of encounter people who believe some of the most extreme conspiracy theories. But then there's another level in which it's not entirely wrong either. And so I wanted to talk to you guys about this. And first, what do you guys think about the dead internet theory and this big conspiracy theory? I mean, are we real?
I ask myself that question a lot.
I was going to say, this is just the reformulation of a very, very long-standing existential crisis, right? Like the other mind's problem.
Yes.
How do I know that anybody's real? I know I am real, but how do I know anybody else is real?
Right. All my knowledge of the world is filtered through my senses, and
right,
my senses can lie. You can see hallucinations, you can feel as hallucinations even, and hear things that aren't there. And if I'm just a brain in a vat with data being fed to it, how do I know?
Right.
It's like the Matrix. Yeah.
And then you have to ask the question, is this really much different than any other situation where we have this kind of crazy, I mean, it really comes back to existentialism, right? This is the, how do we know what is real and what's not? Mm-hmm. And then like you said, the danger with this one and with all conspiracy theories is that there's enough truth to it that it's really hard to disagree with the ethos,
yes,
of what it's saying, while at the same time going, well, that's obviously not true because I know real people and I have run into them online or met them in real life or, you know, chatted with them via video chat. So yeah, I'm not, it's difficult.
But the thing I think is most interesting about this is that this conspiracy theory really was just ahead of its time in terms of the problems, because we're getting to the point now with AI where, I mean, I don't think we're at that point yet, but I think we're maybe 2 or 3 years away from you could video chat with someone and believe and think they're real and then have them actually not be real. So this is one of those things where I think it's a conspiracy theory. And as with most of those, they vastly overestimate the competence of the government.
Right.
But I think this is something that could actually become an issue, not in the holistic sense of what they're saying, but where people are talking to other people who they believe are real and they're completely fabricated.
Now, to go back to the people think things are fabricated, even though they are real, I have actually a real world example of this right here within the StarQuest production network. So on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, we've often had readers, people who read quotes on I Do It. My wife, Melanie, has done it. My daughter, Isabella, has done it. And, where we read quotes from books or people or whatnot. And we've recently been expanding that to have other people come in and help out. And so in our most recent episode, episode 307 on after-death communications, we had the wonderful Alex Murray, who is, you can hear on the Secrets of Sacred Art podcast and the Secrets of Middle Earth. And she did those readings for the female voice. And we had not one, but two people complain that we were using AI voices and it made it very difficult to listen to. It was very off-putting. And I said, that's interesting. I mean, that's actually a real person. And to their credit, the people who read it were very apologetic and they're like, I don't understand why. Now, Alex is a American living in Britain who used to live in Norway. And she admits that some of her diction may be kind of off a little bit, she's intentionally flatten her diction. So it maybe comes across as a little artificial accent, maybe, but it's this idea that at this point in time, I think people think more things are bad than they are. Like we're primed to expect that something is a scam, a fake, a catfish, what's the other one? The gaslight, we're primed to expect that sort of thing now.
Well, I will say I've been accused of being an AI bot writing occasionally in emails that I write because I history of being an English teacher and having, a broader vocabulary that I'm careful not to overuse because I'm used to dealing with children. So like there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. So I'm very careful about the way I phrase things and the way I word things. And so it sometimes comes across in a very stilted way. But then the one that bothers me is like, when you search online for information and it's about a common enough topic, you'll land on one of those pages that's just obviously word vomit.
Yes.
And it's obviously non-human word vomit, right. Just to fill the page. And it's about the question that you asked, but it's not exactly about the question that you asked.
And it's always like a website that's like the Times of some random town in Illinois. Like there's exactly, all these old news sites that have these articles on them now.
We talked about that on a recent episode of this show about how there's this problem of all of these community newspapers that have closed up shop and all their domain names being bought up by somebody, and they try to track down who actually is behind all this. And then these fake news sites get put up in their place, which, as the article, as the Atlantic article points out, always seem to have articles about the supermoon and the blue moon and the pink moon and like lots of articles about the moon. Like, for, like something out there thinks that everyone wants to know about the moon. Yeah, there is a lot of garbage out there. That's part one of the truths in this conspiracy theory is there's a lot of fake bot traffic on the internet. There's a lot of fake websites and fake accounts on X and other social media. You go onto YouTube, it doesn't take long to find even like fake generated bot videos that are just crazy, like drug fueled fever dreams.
The kids ones are bizarre.
And another part of the problem is we are subject to algorithms, you know, on social media, especially, that do encourage us to engage in the same kind of content over and over. Oh, you looked at this. Here's some more of that. And here's a whole avalanche more of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we get siloed into these, you know, these bunkers that just get filled with the same content. And it's easy to say, see, this is just bots, you know, dumping stuff on me. And it's like, It's hard to say, you know, that's not true because that is happening. I just don't think it's as prevalent. I don't think it's like it's not the extreme theory where the internet is dead and it's only this other thing. But it is a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will say I'm reading an interesting book right now. It's called Techno-Feudalism and How Capitalism Died, or How It Killed Capitalism, one of the two. And the basic theory that's coming out of this is the fact that there are these new feudal lords that are controlling the internet, and it's, you know, your big guys, the ones you expect, Amazon and whatever.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that they actually have gotten to the point where they own kind of our thought space and our existence online in a way that we can't. We're digital serfs now, and we serve them. They grant us the ability to use the market, but they extract from us a heavy tax in doing so. And it's a really interesting book. The author is a Greek politician, and so he's got a lot of kind of out there theories too. So it's exciting getting, but when you read through some of the more out there concepts, he makes a good point about this, and I feel like that's kind of what this the best outcome of thinking of this dead internet theory is to say, hey, maybe I need to be more technically literate in the things that I'm reading online, but then also to start being leery about how much of my online existence is owned by someone else's opinion of what I should be seeing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time on the internet way back when, you know, we had blogs and we had, even before that, BBSs that we ran ourselves that you could dial into. And, you know, there were spaces that were not corporate, were not owned by other people, that we had our own servers. And I suppose even then, you know, the backbone of the internet was still a corporate thing. But even more so now, I mean, you just can't, there's nowhere to go online that isn't somebody else's space, really. You know, people don't generally, you know, own their own websites anymore. Not like even before that long ago. We're generally encountering each other on TikTok, Facebook, X, Google, you know, YouTube, those big platforms. And we get fed everything, Amazon and Netflix and whatnot. You know, there a lot of science fiction posits like this future where corporations have overtaken governments as the rulers of the planet. And as you see these mega corporations kind of squat across borders, you know, and you see the EU trying to regulate Google, which is in every country and it's so huge, or Apple or Facebook or whatever, you know, it starts to sink in that it wouldn't take much for these companies to get so big where they just say, I refuse to follow your laws, you know, and we're the feudal lords, like you mentioned, and you have to abide by our rules.
And how do you stop them? That's the kind of scary thing. Like right.
The Butlerian what do you do, jihad.
Well, especially when they've got a server farm in the US and a server farm in East Europe. If you go take the server farm in the US, well, they just roll everything over to East Europe, and now that's where it's running from. Right. And then they just move it to somewhere else after that. And then
they turn off access to your citizens, and the citizens say, hey, I want access back. I'm voting you out of office if you don't stop messing with my Facebook account, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's scary. People, you're right. Education is a key aspect to this. And also a realization that not all of life needs to be online, and not all of life is online. I know so many people who don't spend any time on social media. You know, I mean, I know a lot of people who are on social media. This is where I work and live. But I recognize so many people who they don't spend their days on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, these other spaces. And they're better for it in some ways. I mean, you know, it's not that all these things are terrible, but, you know, they're not bound to it. On the other hand, I see a lot of young people who spend all their time in these places. And that kind of scares me because, sure, you know, when the generation that's over the age of 35 is gone and that generation has grown up, will they have learned in the interim not to put so much of themselves into these spaces owned by these companies?
Well, yeah, no, a good testament to what the algorithm does is whenever you get onto a new social media account and they first peg you just for your age, gender, and they decide to throw things at you that fit that age and gender, and you're like, whoa, this is not the space I wanted to be in. It's been my experience with TikTok, where it's just like, I started my account and it knows how old I am and knows I'm a male, and the stuff that it's throwing at me, I'm like, I need to work this algorithm. So I started Instagram, like finding good creators.
Instagram's the same way. The interesting thing is I push the algorithm in a direction that I want to go to. Let's say, you know, barbecue, smoked meats and world war history, you know, cause I'm a male over the age of 40, and, but every once in a while it wants to push in some, you know, young scantily clad women, you know, that's it always wants to do that. And it's almost like the, you know, I'm not one to go here, but it is almost like the tool of the devil in that sense. Yeah. You have to actively stay virtuous online. You know, it is a constant battle that you can't give into. It's fascinating to see how that works. Although I am hopeful how often it's wrong in the things it shows me. Although it may be a double fake where it's like, we need to show them wrong stuff every once in a while, so they don't think we know more than we do. They think we know less than we do.
Well, no, actually that worries me because that's part of the algorithm just testing the waters, right? Where it's like, well, do they like this thing too? Okay, well, how about this thing? And so it's just serving you up random things on a platter that like, well, other people like this. Other people like this person, like this thing. So let's try this out.
It's training itself.
And and that's exactly what it is.
So it's getting smarter. That's great. There was that one time back in 2020 when Facebook was showing me ads for portable morgues. And also guns and other stuff. And I'm like, what is it you think I am, Facebook?
Vampire Slayer.
Yeah. I guess I'm about to go on a rampage or something. So anyway, back to the dead internet theory. It is true that there are a lot of bots, and AI is starting to, machine learning chat generators that we have, ChatGPT, Gemini, and Microsoft Copilot and the like. We're starting to see them fill some spaces up. And one of the things I really thought was funny, this was from a Forbes article on the same thing, was how people are filling up Amazon listings. They've proven that how many Amazon listings are just shovelware of generated content, because there was like a series of listings where it says, oh, I'm trying to find it now. It was hysterical. All of the listings were, I'm sorry, but I cannot fulfill this request. It goes against OpenAI use policy. My purpose is to provide helpful and respectful information to users in brown. That was the name of the thing. Like, these people aren't even paying attention. They're just saying generate nonsense and post it. And they weren't even paying attention to what was coming at the other end. Would you buy a $325, I don't know, looks like an end table or something, with that on it? Like, man, talk about putting a red flag up so I know not to buy something.
Yeah.
So,
it's just lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's a lot of Amazon, frankly. That's a whole nother conversation we can have about how much of Amazon listings are just junk, terrible stuff that's just shoveled on there. There's a lot of that. This is a conversation we can continue to have, just about how much of the internet is nonsense out there, and scams. Yeah. So that's all uplifting. Anything else we want to say about the dead internet theory before we move on?
I think that the comforting thing here, and we're gonna revisit this,
yes,
because one of our headlines comes kind of back to this, yep, the same kind of concept. But I think one of the comforting things here is that we are getting to a point where we are all becoming overfed on the amount of information that's available to us. And that's a good thing, because one, it's causing us to be more wary consumers, more aware of what we're reading, mm-hmm, and more conscious about the intake that we have. But it's also causing us to disconnect. And we're all starting to think very seriously about stepping away, stepping outside, touching some grass.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is going to push that more, because our kids are growing up. My kids are growing up in an era when it's so overwhelming for them just from the get-go that they are retreating to reliable sources of information. So actually printed sources of information. My kids love the encyclopedia, because they can go find an answer there and they know it's the answer. Right. They know it's not some made up junk, or they don't have to wade through this, 8-page long thing that just keeps scrolling forever and ever to find a decent answer. They can go right to the encyclopedia, look for the highlighted words, and there they are. So I like that aspect of it. I think that's the good part of this internet dying on us kind of thing.
And I have noticed kind of along the lines of what you were talking about, Thomas, with my son is 7. So I've decided to start teaching him how to do electronics projects and coding and stuff. And the most effective way of doing that has been buying those physical project books and then using a old laptop that's not connected to the internet to do all these projects. And that you get way more, I think the information retention is just much higher when you're working with physical paper and just one focused thing, rather than let's just watch this YouTube video that tells us how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Translating from written text on a page to action is very different from just physically aping the steps that I see in a video. I agree with that. That's true for me too. And, Thomas, about what you were saying about people are are getting warier of the things that they, you know, when I see people go, oh yeah, Facebook is listening to me through my phone or Apple or whoever. And you know, sometimes I, when I want to see ads for something, I just yell it at the phone 10 times or, and I'm like, you know, I want to say that's really not how it works. It's actually the reason you see the ads you do is because of your behavior and they have the, you, but I'm like, you know what? Maybe it's okay if they think that. Maybe maybe people should distrust their phones and their Bluetooth speakers and technology a little more than we do. Even if it's probably a little wrong, maybe that's probably for the best.
Yeah,
just saying. I think so. All right. All right. Let's move on to some headlines. But before we do that, I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Technology, including Robert H., Father Stephen W., Carrie O., Christy R. and James M. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Technology and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So our first headline is one of these cautionary tales. The headline from boingboing.net is innocent St. Louis family terrorized in SWAT raid over stolen AirPods. So what happened here is that in St. Louis last May, I think it was in May of 2023, there was a carjacking and some AirPods were in the car, and AirPods have Find My, and the person whose car was carjacked told the police. So they opened up the Find My app and they saw that it was at this house in this neighborhood, and on that basis got a no-knock search warrant. Or I don't know if it was no knock or not, but it was a search warrant with a SWAT team that busted down the door, came you know, barging in, ransacked the house, put holes in the walls and in the ceiling, and terrorized this poor family. And in the end, it turns out the AirPods were in the street in front of the house, because that's probably where the carjackers threw them out the window, because they knew that there was Find My on AirPods. What do you guys think of this? I mean, this is terrible. You and I would know, don't rely on Find My to be that accurate.
Right. I want to know why they decided this was the best way to handle the situation, no matter what. That's pretty much my take on it. The whole thing, just me.
Yeah. It doesn't describe the carjacking itself, but I assume maybe it was a very violent carjacking. I don't know.
Or that there were guns in the car. Like, that's the only thing I can assume, is that there were some kind of weapons in the car. And that means that going in to collect the stolen goods would mean that you were going into somewhere where there were weapons. But even then, it's just like, it seems very, very overkill. The way the article reads, it's almost like the AirPods were the only thing that were stolen. And
yeah,
like it would have been cheaper just to buy the person a new set of AirPods and just forget about it.
Well, and I think the kind of the vibe I get from the article is that it downplays the carjacking part, and partially probably just for political reasons, but probably also for sensational headline clicks. Like, this wasn't about the AirPods. The AirPods were used to try to locate where the carjacking had gone, and they got it wrong. And that is also a big mess up on their part.
Right.
Yeah.
If you click through to the original local paper story, it says that the carjacking happened 12 hours prior, 16 miles away, around 6 a.m. Two brothers were leaving Waffle House, because that's when you leave Waffle House at 6 a.m. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Waffle House. Yeah. There you go.
And it was probably a long night for those guys. And they were carjacked by a group of six people. Two of the carjackers took off in the brothers' Dodge Charger, which is a souped-up car. And it said that the application for a search warrant said they had reason to believe that firearms, ammunition, holsters, and other firearm-related material were inside.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But still, it's just like there's so little due diligence based on the Find My app, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't base your whole police force on the Find My app.
You can't just bust into a house based on what Find My says. It just, this happens too often. We've talked about it before. Like, people have had other people show up at their house, you know, like, give me back my phone. It's, I know it's in here. And it's like, it's not that accurate. And Apple and Google have to do a better job of letting people know, like, it's sort of in this area probably, but that's not 100%. Don't go violent on people based on this. You know,
I think crazy. That they're like, based on the amount of stories that we see about this kind of thing, there, I imagine there's going to, at some point, there needs to be some sort of legislation that says Find My is not allowed to be used as a police investigation tool or admissible in court as evidence.
Mm-hmm. Or at least the sole basis or the primary basis. You know, they should have, okay, Find My says the AirPods are here. Okay, let's do some more police work.
Let's look on the ground.
Right, or do some surveillance. Do we see anybody going in and out of this house that may look like the suspects? Is the stolen car nearby? You know, right. Or see if we can locate the actual AirPods, you know, in the area and narrow it down to the maybe the house itself. And I mean, it's just, it feels like in this case, they just didn't bother doing anything except say, that's the one, let's break in. It just, you're right. I mean, it's what's going to happen is this family is suing the police department for ransacking their house.
Good.
Didn't even repair the damage. You know, they had to do it themselves. But I wonder if people are going to start suing the manufacturers. They're going to sue Apple or Google or whoever, Tile or whoever, you know, the various companies are, and, you know, get them to do a better job of not necessarily improving the technology. I'm sure they want to do that, but a better job of making sure people know, like police know, you cannot rely on this as the primary means of determining where something is.
Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of Apple, this other one story is also related to Apple. Apple has relented and has suddenly started allowing game emulators in its app stores. You can now download a Game Boy emulator, a Commodore 64 emulator, and run them on your iPad, your iPhone, your M1 Mac, or even Vision Pro. Although, to be fair, you could always, there's always been game emulators you could run on a Mac because it's not walled garden. You can run, you know, third party software on there. You'd have to get it from Apple. But it's kind of fascinating. Apple had kind of treated game emulators as piracy software for a long time. But they suddenly changed their mind. What do you think?
I am glad that people who have iPhones and iPads can finally play games. I've got an Android, so this has never been a problem for me.
Old news.
Yes, I know. For Android folks, that's not been an issue. What it boils down to is an emulator is not a problem. It's, it's the software that you're running on it. Is it your software? Is it pirated software? But that's always been an issue with computers. So
it is interesting that this comes right on the heels of Nintendo suing Yuzu, who they made an emulator. It's a Switch emulator and also a Nintendo DS emulator, and they just got completely shut down by Nintendo. And I think that's probably because the Switch is their current system, but I would be interested to see if Nintendo becomes more aggressive than they already are, to be honest.
They're pretty aggressive already.
With now that Apple is doing it, because with Android, like, there are emulators on the Android store, but the best ones are the ones that you have to sideload yourself.
Interesting. I wonder, there's been some speculation whether it's related to the EU's requirement that Apple set up an ability to sideload outside of the App Store and that sort of thing. Whether it signals a sea change within Apple's thinking about apps and what it allows in and doesn't. I mean, all of these apps still have to go through the approval process, and they still have to, have the privacy guidelines and all that sort of stuff. So it's not like a free for all at the moment, but it's sort of an interesting indicator of where maybe things are changing a little bit here, that they're a little bit more open. All right. So, Thomas, I think this is the article we were talking about that was related to the dead internet theory article. This is an article from sciencealert.com, And it says AI could explain why we're not meeting any aliens, a Wild study proposes. Now, that headline's a little misleading. It's not that like ChatGPT is explaining to us. Let me start from the basic. There's a theory called the Fermi paradox, which it's the discrepancy between the apparent high likelihood of advanced civilizations existing due to the number of stars in the universe and how many must be like Earth with the habitable planets, and the total lack of evidence that they exist. Although I would say there might be some evidence that they're out there, but you know that's a controversial theory. You know, listen to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World for more of that. But there are many theories proposed why there's this discrepancy, why there's no evidence of other alien civilizations. And one of the ideas is the Great Filter. And this is a hypothesis that says that there's the high likelihood of a cataclysmic event occurring to prevent intelligent life from becoming interplanetary, whether it's a nuclear war, an asteroid that wipes out all life, you know, supernovas, that sort of thing. This theory says that AI is that great filter event where once AI becomes artificial superintelligence, think Terminator, think The Matrix, that basically is the endpoint of civilization, and it progresses no further, it dies off in every instance. What do you think of this? This is kind of interesting. It's very pessimistic way of looking at things.
It's also very the thing that really gets me about this one is the nuclear war one has always bothered me because it suffers from the same problem I'm about to describe, but it bothers me less than this one, and the reason is because this is a very self-important filter event, mm-hmm. right? Like, of course, every civilization that comes to the point where it's going to become intelligent and reach space will develop exactly the same industrial complex with the same computing technology that we do, because it's the only way to do it, or it's the best way to do it because we did it, you know?
Right.
And it just bothers me so much that like this would be the filter. Now, I get it. But the funny thing about the filter is that there's always different things to point at. Like you can always get, it's climate change that must cause the problems. So you can always look for the next end of the world event as the great filter. But it's so self-important to say that it must be something that we're doing that causes or that these intelligent races are doing that cause the great filter to come about.
It's the bumpy head alien theory, which is, because in Star Trek, all aliens look just like us, except they have different kinds of bumps in their foreheads. And their societies are just like ours, except they have funny names and funny hats. Like, right? And so yep. I think some of these scientists have kind of fallen into this trap of thinking sci-fi is a reflection. What do you think, Jack?
I think that, this is just my general problem with the Fermi paradox, is that most people who write about it seem to misunderstand it, that it's just like an interesting thought experiment. It doesn't really mean anything, because you can plug in whatever numbers you want into it and get wildly different results. Mm-hmm. But I guess my main thing that it makes me think about is everyone should go read both The Three Body Problem and the Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky if you want to see very, mm-hmm. very interesting explorations of alien civilizations that are wildly different from Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't read The Three Body Problem, but I watched the Netflix series, and wow.
Yeah.
Mm. It was, I really liked it. I'm interested in reading the book now, but I mean, the problem with the Fermi paradox is the way people approach it is, well, how would we know? Like, maybe they are out there, but they're so far away. How would we even know they're there? It's like saying, there must not be anybody who lives in Asia because, I can't see them. Like, they're so far away. Yeah. Like, how would I know? I mean, it's like people in Europe thinking that the world is flat and you're going to sail off the edge, you know?
It's like, the really cute thing here too is that we haven't even made it outside of our own planet's orbit. Like, we have not escaped our own planet's gravitational pull. So for us to say there must not be anything out there. It's like, how could we possibly make that assumption, right? And I really like Star Trek's take on it too, where it's until we discover faster than light travel, the other races that have already discovered faster than light travel are not going to interact with us out of a sense of preserving us, so that we can develop that on our own, if we will, or if not, we'll die out the way that we live. And I really like that idea. I think that's something that holds a lot of merit, because, you know, you look at our society today, there's still tribes that exist in regions that are very separate from society, and we've declared them World Heritage. They mm-hmm. they are supposed to be left alone, and that's the general consensus, is that we're going to leave them alone to do what they will, because that's their livelihood and their lifestyle, and it's not our place to walk in and mess with them.
Right.
Yep. Earth is the Sentinel Island of the galaxy currently. Mm-hmm. They probably come and look at us, but we can't see them because we're much more primitive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We also have a sample size. Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say all this stuff is like based on a sample size of one. Like, we know about our planet, we don't know anything else about anyone else, so we can't say anything else about it, really.
Mm-hmm. If we had at least met one other civilization, then we could compare and say, okay, so they're like that and we're like this, so it's still a very small sample size, but at least it tells us something. But you're right. Like, mm-hmm. all of these are valid points. We barely have made it outside the orbit of our... We haven't put any people past our moon, although didn't SpaceX did that. Yeah, but...
Well, the Russians might have, but that's a different topic.
Accidentally.
Not on purpose.
Yeah, I've heard that one too. We should do that in Mysterious World. That would be a good topic. So in any case, this physicist, I mean... I don't know. I mean, I don't want to, you know, slag him because you're based on the one thing, but it just goes to show, just because someone has a degree in physics doesn't mean they've thought things through and whatnot. We do need to be wary of artificial intelligence getting out of control and doing, you know, and being used as a tool that is dangerous, like a lot of other things, but it's the scary thing of du jour. And, mm-hmm. you know, 50 years ago, it was ice ages and nuclear weapons, and now it's climate change and artificial intelligence. So I'm not worried about an extinction event 200 years after the Industrial Revolution began due to artificial intelligence. So, all right. Our last headline is on this story about a backdoor that was discovered that someone was trying to slip into a very basic part of Linux, the XZ backdoor. What's going on with this?
You want to go, Thomas?
I'll go. Okay. Yeah. So this is really cool, because it's like so much of my nerdness comes out of this one. So this is an open source project that's kind of at the root of a lot of what you do in Linux. So it's XZ is like zip. So if you know zip files, you know something similar to the way that like an XZ file works. And what was happening was that we don't actually know who is in charge of XZ. It's a persona that's in charge of it, but it's been around for so long that it's probably not the same person, but that persona is still in charge of it. And there was some stuff happening to the code. There were some changes that were made to the code that were going to allow a backdoor using really, really clever procedure based on key checking and fallbacks inside of the Linux kernel that have existed forever. And, it was really neat, very, very subtle, and it was discovered because it's open source. So this is my favorite part of it. It's like, everybody's like, well, open source is really dangerous. Well, yes, it is, but it's really cool because everybody gets to read the code. And a guy at Microsoft discovered this, a software engineer discovered this code change before it got committed and distributed. And what was happening was whoever was doing this was doing it very, very gradually and very carefully to try and avoid exactly this kind of detection. But when you have as many eyes on this kind of basic product as you do, it gets caught, fortunately, like this one did. So it didn't actually make it into the wild, but it would have been really, really devastating, because it's essentially like any packages that you got were going to be able to be hijacked and used as a basis to bounce off of and get access to your computer.
Yeah. And the reason that would be so bad is I don't know how many people realize it, but the entire internet runs on Linux servers. So it's not just your hobbyist desktop is going to get messed up. It's the internet could be destroyed. It'd be really dead then.
I like to imagine in my fever dreams as a thriller military or a spy thriller author that this was like the China has this huge department of hackers. So does North Korea. So does Russia. So one of them, you know, started like just the story of how this happened. Like in 2021, this user made their first known commit to the project, and then to a project, not the same one, but no one noticed at the time, but it got them in the door. And then the next year they submitted a patch to XZUtils, and then almost immediately a never before seen participant, someone who just joined, says Colin, who is an actual person, the longtime maintainer of XZUtils, well, he hasn't been active enough. He needs to bring in this guy to be a additional developer on the project. And then some other people who also had never been active before, they joined in and said, yeah, they should. And so he did. And then this person in January 2023 made their first change to XZUtils, and then they gradually started making very subtle changes that opened up the door to them being able to make the big change without being detected. And I'm like, this is like spy thriller level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild.
It really is.
It's so devious. I'm thinking it's either that or it's like one of those big Russian cyber hacking conglomerates, which like Russian organized crime actually went out and hired a bunch of cyber hackers or otherwise co-opted them or whatever. That's where a lot of this ransomware stuff comes from, the big money stuff. So it's fascinating to think about who might be actually behind this and how close we just came to, like you said, an apocalyptic event where someone could have eventually, once this propagated out, had a backdoor into any web server, any server on the internet.
Yeah. I love how it was discovered by the Microsoft developer, which now think about this as I'm talking about it as like a scene in a Christopher Nolan movie, because that's what it needs to be now, the spy thriller. Right. He was doing testing on a Postgres SQL databases, and he noticed that there was it was taking a few more cycle counts than it usually did on the CPU. So it was like this minuscule like uptick in CPU cycle counts. And he's like, huh, that's weird. And that's what started him down finding out what was actually causing that. It was just like crazy.
Thank God for nerds.
Just so everybody is comfortable. Yeah, I was just going to say, just so everybody's comfortable with the fact that is like my everyday existence. They were like, this took like two extra CPU cycle counts, but that turns into like nine extra hours worth of work because when you're running, you know, thousands of calls a second. It adds up.
It adds up. Yeah. Right. You want every cycle counts. So kind of wild. Thanks for bringing that to my attention. That was, when you think about it, you dig past the very technical stuff. It's a cool spy story. And
yeah.
All right, so those are our headlines, and let's move on to our picks of the week. Jack, you're up first. What's your pick this week?
My pick of the week, as ironic as it may be, because of all the time we talked about AI on this show, is actually Microsoft Copilot, which I'm surprised I'm positively reviewing a Microsoft product, but I've been using it a lot recently as I've been doing some development work and some IT work, and it's actually really, really useful. Like, it just pops up in the little panel on the side and I can ask it technical questions. Like, I was doing something in Vim and I wanted like a cheat sheet of all the Vim commands, and it gives me that. Or I had some issues generating some certs and I got it to give me the steps, and just it's like conversational search, and it gives you the information you need, and then you can act on it. And I don't have to go, like you said earlier, Dom, scrolling through Stack Overflow to find what I need. Mm-hmm. So I've been surprised by how helpful it is and how unobtrusive it is otherwise. Like, I know a lot of people are hating on Windows 11, but I think the way they've integrated Copilot so far, at least, is very useful and very helpful, especially for technical things like that. So I definitely recommend it. It's, if you have a Windows 11 computer, it's on there, so you don't need to go buy it or anything, but check it out and don't let the name Microsoft put you off from it.
I'm just waiting for them to make a Clippy skin for it. That's what I want.
Hey, it looks like you're trying to do a thing. You could actually, there's a Copilot app for the iPhone and that sort of thing too. So it's not just for Windows. I mean, it's really useful because it's right there on the Windows taskbar, right? It's right there on the screen. But you can use Copilot, and underneath Copilot is GPT-4. I mean, that's
right. It is just Microsoft's implementation of ChatGPT. So
that's awesome. I mean, we were talking before the show just about how we are both, you know, finding new uses for it all the time. I use it every day, literally, to help me do the podcast, to make summaries and juice up my social media posts and that sort of stuff. I've used it to run thought experiments in a conversational way and go back and forth or that sort of thing. And I'm just really looking forward to the day when it has that real time search function where it knows everything that's on the internet now, as opposed to the last time they trained it 6 months ago or whatever. And it stops hallucinating, which is a real, still an issue, where it makes up stuff. So once we get to that point, it'll be really useful. It'll be more useful. Thomas, what's your pick this week?
All right. So mine's kind of an advice piece. I have been wrestling with this for years and I had no idea. So my wife uses iDevices. She's an Apple user. She really has gotten really into it. She's had an iPhone forever.
You are a lucky man.
She just got, so that's the thing. She got an iWatch, or she got the watch, and then she got an iPad, and she was using them on the regular. And we were realizing that a lot of the people that were texting us about things that the kids were doing were expecting me to get texts. And I was not getting the texts. She was getting the texts. And what was happening was I was the owner of the I account. So when we started buying these devices, I already had an Apple account. So we just threw them onto my account because I didn't need them for myself, but she could just use the account that I had. Well, turns out that if you are messaging an iPhone from an iPhone, even if you have the person's number in, very often it will go directly to the email instead that's associated with the account.
Right.
And so all of the messages that were intended to go to both of us were going just to her twice, but not showing up as if they were twice. And it took us a long while to figure that out.
Right.
Like I said, it's been happening for years. Didn't realize it. My dad was bothered by it enough that he just got WhatsApp and started messaging me on WhatsApp instead. We finally figured it out. And I just want to commend Apple for how easy it is to change your account information. Mm-hmm. So they verified everything. So it wasn't like it was so easy that a hacker could do it and I wouldn't have known. But it was really just simple to go on and click the button, change the email address. It verified it with my email. I just clicked the verification link and then everything was good to go. And it was really simple, made it a very easy process and changed it on all of the devices pretty quickly. And now we're up and running and I can actually get the messages from the people that are supposed to go to me.
Nice. Before they had family sharing, this was a very common thing. People would use one Apple account for the family or whatever, because then they wouldn't have to buy apps twice and that sort of thing. But this is a sort of problem because Apple wants us so that when you send an iMessage, it goes to all your devices, not just your phone. But if you send it to just the phone number, that's the only place it's going. So if you have an iCloud account associated with your iPad or whatever, it'll send it to the account on those. And you're right. So your phone number was still associated with that account. So you needed to get her onto her own, like separate the phone number essentially. So, and Apple, to their credit, when they came out with family sharing and all that sort of stuff, they knew this was a problem, which is why they did family sharing, and were ready on day one to help people separate things out. So you're right. I mean, that is, it is, I've gone through this myself, and Pat Scott helps people with this all the time. I know she's like, this is a regular occurrence. So that's a good thing to remember is, you know, if you are still sharing an Apple account with somebody, it's time to go your own way, to at least to, and maybe just even do family sharing, but separate things out. That's good. All right. So my pick this week is an iPad case that I got for my daughter. She has an iPad. I think it's ninth generation, whatever. One of the iPad, not Air, not Pro, full size, 10.2 inch. And she wanted to make sure that it had a keyboard. And that's been an issue, is a case is a case. But a keyboard case, unless you're paying the massive money for the Apple keyboard case, which is way more than it, and I would want to pay. You know, you end up with a lot of the janky things, and the Bluetooth thing is the issue, is because if it doesn't use the smart connector is almost like being physically plugged in. It is physically plugged in, and it's got that responsiveness. But if you go with the Bluetooth, you know, a lot of these Bluetooth cases, the connectivity is slow. It takes forever for it to wake up. You have to tap keys and wait for it to connect and all that sort of thing. So we wanted something pretty good. And so we got this one, and it's worked out really well for her. It's the, speaking of AI-generated names, the Boruan new iPad keyboard case with lots of, you know, descriptors in the thing. I'll put a link in the show notes, of course. And it's $26. In fact, there's a 5% coupon on it, so it's even less than that. And it's got, let me see here. I've got an issue with Safari Amazon, where the images disappear, the product images disappear after like 30 seconds. I don't know why. It's really weird. But it's backlit. The keys are backlit. There is a slot for the Apple Pencil to be slotted in. This is the kind that doesn't have the magnetic pencil. It's the old style where it sticks in the side. But there's a slot for it to lock in. So it's a really nice keyboard. And the battery lasts forever. I mean, I got this for her last September, and I think she's maybe charged it once, if that. I mean, it's really been pretty good. So and for the price, it's really, really good price. So
I like that the keyboard's removable too. That's a feature that is very, very underappreciated in some of these. When the keyboard's built into the thing, it's very complicated to do stuff with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of Velcroed, so you can Velcro it, and then you've got this flat surface that's the iPad cover that you can still prop up the iPad without the keyboard. But then you can actually put the keyboard in your lap or move it somewhere else and still use it because it's Bluetooth. It doesn't need to be physically connected. So
nice.
Yeah, it's good. I recommend it. So that does it for this episode. And we would love to hear from you and what you thought of any part of our discussion. You're free to speculate whether we're actual people or not, or just deep fakes. You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/technology or the StarQuest Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Send an email to technology@sqpn.com. Visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. And you can find links from our discussion and our picks of the week on our show notes at starquest.fm/TEC252. That's the show number. Be sure to follow The Secrets of Tech in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, in your favorite podcast app, or at the StarQuest YouTube channel, youtube.com/StarQuestMedia, where you should make sure to hit the bell to get notifications. And until next time, Jack Barazzini, thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of technology.
Thanks, Dom.
Thomas Sanjuro, thank you as well.
Been great.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to the Secrets of Technology on StarQuest.